Hey, this is John Lee Dumas of the award-winning podcast, Entrepreneurs on Fire, and you're listening to the Excelsior Journeys with George Soroy. Prepare to ignite.
So would you say that that's kind of like the lightning bolt moment for
you? And that's
why
I taught myself how to draw, was actually the Little Mermaid, drawing stills of Ariel.
I've got better things to do tonight than die.
Sylvester jumped out of his chair and said, who the F is this?
I remember walking out of the theater with him saying, I'm going to write Halloween.
I'm rather impressed with your research. Rarely do people ask me about Children in the Corn.
It doesn't have to be perfect. Just do it. You know, throw some spaghetti against a wall. See if it sticks.
This is George Soroy saying to all of you, ever upward. Part of the Podmatch Podcast Network. This is George Soroy, and thank you so much for being here. And one of the main elements that I really love to celebrate here are the people that are not only constantly getting their work out there, but are also reaching back to make sure that other people have the wherewithal to get their work out there as well. That is exactly what John Dudakis has been doing. After 7 years of working as an editor on CNN's The Situation Room with Wolf Blitzer, he has gone on to become an award-winning novelist. He is a writing coach. He is a motivational speaker. He is a manuscript editor. He has done so much for so many other people, so many other creatives. And that is something that is truly worth celebrating, especially here on this show, on Excelsior Journeys, The Road to Creativity. And it is my deep pleasure to introduce my guest this week, Mr. John Dudakis. John, how are you, sir?
I'm fine, George. Thanks very much for this opportunity and this great introduction. I don't even recognize the guy that you're talking about.
That is something that I pride myself on, is getting the best possible introductions for my guests, because deserve it. They have reached out to me, or I've reached out to them to become a guest on my show, and it's a pleasure to have people of your caliber on here. And I am just really excited to get to hear more about your own journey in this crazy world that we're in right now.
Oh, it's crazy, all right.
Oh yeah. So for starters, you've recently come out with your sixth novel, is that right?
Sixth novel. It came out in July of 2024, Enemies Domestic, based on the oath of office for public officials that they pledged to protect the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic.
Oh, okay. So this should go in the current affairs section of
it's fiction.
Of the bookstores now.
It's a political thriller ripped from reality.
Gotcha. Yep. But in the meantime, you've also been doing a whole lot of work, not only for other people and other creatives, but you've also been doing quite a bit of motivational speaking and podcasting as well, from what I've seen.
All of that. I started doing a podcast when COVID happened, where everybody was locked down. Zoom became a big deal. And I began to realize, I know how to interview people. So this is just a great way to connect with people. I do it on sort of a whenever basis.
Yeah.
There are about, 100, 150 interviews I've done so far on my website that I've got posted there. And so what I'm spending a lot of time doing now is, in a sense, branching out, not in addition to the writing community that I've been speaking to for the last 20 years, now looking to expand to all avenues of society, taking a message of using writing as a way to heal from grief, because grief is universal, grief and loss. And it doesn't just mean the loss of a loved one. And so corporations have wellness programs, and veterans groups deal with veterans with PTSD. And so I'm expanding to try to reach those groups.
Oh, that's wonderful. That's wonderful. One thing that I've experienced as a creative myself, there's a lot of people in our community that really need that sort of assistance, because we are very prone to dealing with things such as anxiety, depression, procrastination, imposter syndrome, perfectionism. Yeah. These things just ring up one after another. And that's just in my own head. So I can't even imagine what any regular person out there is also dealing with.
Well, you sound like a pretty regular person to me.
I have my moments. I was a theater major in college, so I can put up an excellent front, I guess.
I think what you're describing is again, universal. I think we all have aspects of those things.
Yeah, absolutely. And dealing with grief, not only with the loss of a loved one, but also realizing what it is that you were set on doing, and all of a sudden it's not working, or something is forcing you to go in a different direction. Something is
getting in your way to doing yes. what it is that you feel is your goal, your mission in life, something like that. If anything really destroys any sort of hope in there, then yeah, there's a death, that hole that grief creates a really, really big hole.
It really does. And what you've described, I mean, I can go all the way back to, and this is something I teach in my writing classes, that life doesn't turn out the way you expect.
No.
In journalism, it's a story. In real life, it's often a crisis. And mm-hmm. in fiction, it's a plot twist. We yeah. all have plot twists. And it need not have been brought on by grief or anything like that. It could just be circumstances. Mm-hmm. In my case, it was the Vietnam War and the draft. Mm-hmm. I had no say in what my draft number was going to be. It was low.
Right.
It was 14. And that seemed to set me on a course that I didn't really want to be on.
What was that course?
Well, I mean, I was a student at the University of Wisconsin in Madison in the late 60s. And the war, Vietnam War, was huge. It was in all the papers. 500,000 troops were stationed over there at the time. 200 kids a week were being killed over there. And I say kids, 18, 19, 20, my age. Mm-hmm. And so I had a student deferment, which is fine. But that just delays the inevitable.
Yeah.
And I joined a campus radio station as a reporter. Got tear gassed covering an anti-war riot after Kent State. My parents heard their little boy getting tear gassed on the radio when I did my report. And so they convinced me to switch schools, which was fine, except for the fact that Playboy magazine voted UW-Madison the number one party school in the country. And I saw it as my mission to be the number one partier. I got so good at it that my grade point average was 1.95, just enough to lose my student deferment. Here I am facing the draft
in
the Vietnam War that was a meat grinder. And my dad was on the draft board. So I went to my dad, and before I could even finish asking the question, he said, and this is a quote, "Hell no, I'm not going to get you out of this." And he encouraged me to talk to a recruiter to find out what my options were. And I discovered they had military journalism. So I was I enlisted to avoid the draft, got trained as a journalist. At least that was the very first time I was trained as a journalist. And then here's the plot twist. I got orders to Vietnam, but they were changed at the last minute to Germany. And I spent 2.5 years at the headquarters of the American Forces Radio and Television Network in Frankfurt, Germany, doing interviews for a special events radio unit. And the first interview I was assigned to do was with Alfred Hitchcock.
Oh, wow.
That's what I said.
And that you were literally just a little, like, one different movement away from becoming, say, Private Joker from Full Metal Jacket.
Yeah. And instead, I had this great gig in Frankfurt, Germany, and that was a mentoring moment. My boss could have done the interview in his sleep, and he trusted this 23-year-old kid, and I didn't screw it up. And I went back to, when I got out of the Army, I went back to journalism school at the University of Wisconsin, 3.5 average. I'm not brilliant, but I grew up and found my calling. And so I did journalism for the next 45 years.
Wow, that's amazing. That's amazing. I remember hearing the line that Gallagher once said. He's like, "I went to college for 7.5 years. It was a long war."
Or the way I put it is, I crammed 4 years of school into six.
That's great. I love it. So that feeling of getting to interview an icon like Alfred Hitchcock, was he generous with his time with you?
Oh, no. We had 40 minutes one-on-one in his hotel room. He was pitching or promoting Frenzy, which was the second to the last movie he directed.
Yeah.
And very generous with his time, expansive answers, very much what you already know. It was the persona was the same. I like to go deeper in an interview. Don't like to go for just the canned answers. I try to ask them questions they hadn't been asked before.
And so once that, because I've experienced similar situations like that, finally getting a moment with someone that I hold in high regard, like the great voice actor, Rob Paulsen, who I was a big fan of. We were actually following each other on Twitter, and I was able to reach out to him and tell him how I was getting very close to finishing a Kickstarter campaign to fund my voice lessons. And this was right after I lost my job. So I wanted to kind of thank him in order to just to say, like, your inspiration is a big part of what I'm doing. You and the work you've done and the Zone podcast, Talking Tunes, was a big part of it. Wow. And he was so gracious with his response. And several years later, I wound up meeting him at a convention. And he gave me about a good like 10 or so minutes. And I got it all, like every moment he gave me just like everything. And it was wonderful. It was a wonderful experience. And I was just like flying when I finished that up. And that's after I'd been doing this for about 4 years at this point.
Boy, you're saying something that really resonates, because there's when you think about it, encouragement doesn't cost anything. And yet it can be so valuable to the person you're encouraging. And
I was practically flying when I finished up that interview. It was just like, I knew two things. I knew that was going to be the audio for episode 150 of this show. And I've already surpassed 300 at this point. So, and the other thing was, I actually kind of know what I'm doing. So
I know it takes a while, but
At some point you have to eventually stop listening to those voices that are in your head and start listening to the voices that are actually there.
How were you able to stop listening to those voices and obeying them?
The funny thing is I can't completely drown them out. I can just keep them at bay for a period of time.
Mm-hmm. And any trick to that? What works for you?
It's a difficult one, really. I do have medication that helps, but I've also felt like there are times when it seems to work and other times when maybe it doesn't. A lot of the situations that come into play help me out. If I feel like I'm on the right path on something, if I feel like I'm getting that additional validation, then that's something that I can hold up to myself and say, look, this is what you've done so far.
It goes back to encouragement, right?
A lot of people have vision boards in their offices or whatever, where they put together different things about what they intend to do, different goals that they have. Sometimes they'll put up pictures to show some sort of an illustration of what it is that they are looking at. What I do is I do two things. I have a vision board, which just writes down all the different things that I want to finish that are in the works. But then the other side, I have what I call a mirror board. And what that is a list of all the different things that I've accomplished so far. And it's something that I need to look at from time to time, because I'm not just starting from the bottom on things.
That's helpful. Great.
I would say, like, more than anything, that's been the big help for me.
Okay.
Yeah. And so as you're doing this, as you're getting into journalism and everything, as you've done the time that you've had in Germany, what led you to CNN of all places?
Well, it's always that long and winding road. And in broadcast journalism, often people only stay at like 2 years at a place. And I was always fortunate to be able to stay longer, and because the organizations had a pretty good commitment to the local community. So I was in radio for probably a couple of years after I got out of the Army and while I was in school. And then I transitioned to television. My first television job was at the NBC affiliate in Madison, Wisconsin in 1976. And I was there until 1983. So that was a long time. And then I went to the Christian Broadcasting Network in Virginia Beach. I was with them for 5 years, 2 years as a general assignment reporter. And then I covered the last 3 years of Reagan's presidency as a White House correspondent. This was also at the time when my boss, Pat Robertson, was running for president, which was it was a little dicey. But amazingly, one of the producers I worked with at CBN went to CNN, and she helped grease the skids for me. And so I was able to get hired at CNN in Atlanta as a writer. And CNN, bless their heart, did not see me as damaged goods. And so I was at CNN 25 years, 17 in Atlanta. They made me an editor probably within a year after I joined. And while I was doing that, I needed a creative outlet, because editing was it was tedious, but it paid well. And so that's when I started writing fiction. I left CNN in 2013 when my third novel came out, and I've got six now in print.
Wow. Wow. So what was it like kind of making that pivot over from doing constantly keeping yourself in this world of nonfiction? Obviously, you're drumming up a lot of material.
Well, there are a lot of people who would say that if I worked at CNN, when did I was always making it up. I wasn't. That's a firing offense at any reputable news organization. And to be honest, it took a while to give myself permission to make things up when I was writing fiction, because the story I was writing was sort of ripped from reality and there were certain things that actually happened. But once I was able to break free of the shackles of my own story and embellish and go beyond it, that was very freeing. And yet it didn't slosh into the day-to-day journalism.
Yeah.
So I had sort of the best of both worlds. I was able to make stuff up, but I was also locked into reality.
Oh, that's great. And then to be able to have all that information as well, that's got to help with your world building.
It is. I mean, obviously you write science fiction or fantasy.
Young adult science fiction, yeah.
That really is world building. And I take my hat off to people like you, because that involve a tremendous amount of imagination that I don't have. And yet, to a certain extent, you are building a world, but in the kind of fiction I do, political thrillers, that world already exists. And I'm just trying to make it come alive for the reader. And so my most recent novel, I write as a woman. That's another line of questioning if you want to go there. She's pregnant. She is White House press secretary. She's ambivalent about becoming a single mom. Mm-hmm. The dad is dead. The first question she's asked on the first day on the job comes from a Tucker Carlson type who asks, are you or are you not planning to abort your unborn child? That puts her in the crosshairs, mm-hmm. the highly toxic and polarized abortion debate, mm-hmm. and a dictator becomes president. It could never happen.
No, but, of course not.
But so we're dealing with some real, real important stuff.
Wow. That is definitely, you want to talk about ripped from the headlines. That's definitely all right there. And no, it can't possibly happen here.
Well, and that was the Sinclair Lewis novel way back when, and it can happen here and is happening.
Right.
Here. And yet I'll say, when I wrote the book, this was before Trump was elected the second time. And I've covered abortion. I've been on all sides of the issue. And so when I wrote it, I didn't want it to be a polemic. I wanted people, no matter where they come down on the abortion issue, to feel that their position is fairly represented in the characters that I've created. And based on, I mean, it's won 8 awards so far this year.
Wow.
And I'm getting really fabulous feedback from men and women on the issue. You can't please everybody, but
of course not.
It's been really heartening.
Wow, that's great. That's great. And then as you were writing that first novel, what was that feeling like as everything was coming together and everything was moving along? I felt like when things are really connecting, you're getting that vibe, you're getting that momentum, you're feeling the rhythm and everything going. It feels like nothing's going to stop you from getting this thing done.
Well, it does, but it doesn't. I mean, the first novel, it took 10 years to get the agent that I've got. And it went through 14 major revisions, and she's the 39th agent that I queried. So I tell my writing students, take good notes, and I'll save you 9 years in the process. Because at first, it didn't feel like it was cooking. It didn't feel like it was all coming together. And every bit of feedback I was getting from beta readers showed the deficiencies and encouraged me to get better at my craft. I went to writers' conferences, took classes, read books. But then there comes a point where you're in the zone, what's a good story? Mm-hmm. And then it's just a matter of fine tuning it and hoping you can thread the needle to find that one person who's not your mom, who says, I think I can make money on your writing. And so that was the moment.
That's a beautiful moment too, when you discover that. For my own situation, my agent really she was someone that I befriended the same year because I was co-chairing a conference of my own. And she and I got along great. I reached out to her with a question because I had there was a possibility of something happening with my first white sci-fi book that was going to be bigger than a novel. And I asked her for advice, and we wound up going to the same convention later on that year. We met up for lunch, and by the end of lunch, I had an agent. Like it was
nice. That's wonderful.
It's one of those wonderful experiences that I always say whenever people are saying how all they just need to query the correct agent. Well, there's more than one way to connect with an agent.
You're right. I'm sorry to interrupt.
And one of those ways is just to connect with them at a place like a convention.
That's exactly what happened to me. I met my agent at a writer's conference. And one of the things that I went to the same conference for like 8 years. Mm-hmm. And there was a moment where I think we were waiting for lunch to start. And I was sitting with another agent, not the mm-hmm. one who I'm with now. And we were just talking about our kids and all this kind of stuff. It wasn't a pitch session. And I remember thinking, he's just a guy. He's just yeah. a guy, because it's so easy to put these people on a pedestal and become so mm-hmm. intimidated that you are no longer you when you're relating to them.
Right. Exactly. And being able to kind of relax and have that moment where you can actually talk to someone one-on-one. And even if it's outside the convention itself, if right. they just happen to be sitting at a bar. And at the bar and you approach them, you obviously yep. don't throw your manuscript at them or anything, but you ask them if you can buy them a drink or something and just kind of That's chat it. With them like you would expect someone to chat with you.
Exactly. Yeah. You nailed it. That's exactly it.
One of the things that I've equated some social media to is when it's working right, it can be the world's biggest cocktail party. Yes. And if you're connecting with someone and you're going bouncing back and forth with them and chatting about different things and having fun, the one thing you don't want to do is if you're at a cocktail party, you don't drop a 300 page document in their lap and say, read it and let me know what you think yeah. and then walk away. And yeah. so many people can do that with just sending a DM with a link attached to it. And oh, man. That's an automatic turnoff.
Yep.
Don't do that. Talk to me yep. like I'm a regular human being. This is a spot for this. This is where we network. But this is not where we actually make the deals. We can yeah. make the deals later on.
It's an acquired taste and it takes trial and error to figure it out.
My thoughts. Exactly. Once that book was finished, you went through all the steps, you found your agent, you got everything squared away in terms of the editing, you saw the cover art. What were your thoughts when you had that moment that every author is dying for? Yeah. That moment after all the work, after everything that was done, the editing, the rewriting, the rejections, the approval. And finally, after all that, the big journey, there you are holding that finished book in your hands. What was that?
I mean, I don't even know if I have the words for it, which of course makes no sense because I'm a word guy.
Right.
But it's certainly tremendously fulfilling
yeah.
and encouraging, because it then gives you that reminder, oh, you can do this, dude. And mm-hmm. so I was already working on book two and so on. And it always is a kick yeah. when that book shows up. And in the mail, and you hold it and you go, man, I did this.
Right. Yeah, exactly. It was just like, I pulled this off. Yeah. And I've shown that book, my book so far, to my daughter. And because she's gotten into writing as well. She's going to be 8 years old in a couple of weeks. And nice. she's working on this one story that she's gotten. I love it. I love that she's doing it. And when I show her, when I go to my shelf and I hold up one of the books that I got, and she is just like, how did you write so many words? I was like, well, wow. This one took 5 years. It took five yeah. years to write this one. So wow. There were a lot of words that did not make it in this, but it was worth it. It was worth yeah. it to do it. The more she's doing it, the more she's working on different things at school. I feel like she's getting the hang of it. Yeah. the hang of it. So
that's exciting. Well, my daughter was the same way and ended up getting a PhD in creative writing. Now she's a freelance editor. It started with her. She actually was one of my first beta readers. And I think she was probably in high school at the time. This was when I printed out the manuscript. And at one point she wrote in the margin, and I've saved the page. She yeah. went, S-E-W is for needle and thread. S-O-W is for seed, Mr. Copy Editor.
Oh, I hope you frame that.
I haven't, but I will.
That's great. That is great. And that feeling, too, when you're having done six books now, that yeah. feeling never gets old when it comes holding that finished book in your hands. It almost feels like you're going back to square one, almost, getting that same sort of rush.
Well, and you say square one because, to be honest, every time I sit down to write the next novel, there's the imposter syndrome again. And there's that,
yep.
How did I do that the last time? And mm-hmm. more often than not, I have to go back to my, what do I tell my students? Oh yeah, do that, dude.
Right. I feel like I'm stuck in that same sort of rut right now with book three on this trilogy, because I'm just feeling that sort of intimidation by the fact that book two, as of right now, where I am right now is as a writer, that's the best book I've ever written. The second book of that trilogy. I am so, so proud of that one.
Do you in any way use AI?
No. Not at all.
No.
Not at all. No, 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 no. AI does not exist in this dojo. Like, that is, I'm just so proud of the work that I did with that. And really, a lot of it comes down to having that right kind of editor. As my editor, Rebecca J. Cox, is just absolutely wonderful. She propelled those two books to being the best that they could possibly be, especially that second one. I am grateful. I'm grateful sure. when I see it yeah. because yeah. now I'm just like, okay, here it is, book three. I'm finishing this trilogy. Am I going to stick the landing? Because we've had so many different trilogies out there where that first one starts off great and the second one way even higher and then the third one and they slip. Mm. So many have experienced that. But I'm just thrilled at not only seeing all the work that you've done already, but you've also gotten into editing yourself and being a motivational speaker. Now, what have those experiences been like for you?
The editing thing actually kind of came about inadvertently. The first time I got published, I had credibility as a traditionally published author. So I'd go to a writer's conference. And mm-hmm. and this happened, I think, right after my first book came out. Somebody came up to me, similar to what you've described, and said, here's my 150,000-word tome. Give it a quick read and tell me what you think. Well, there is no such thing with me as a quick read, and yeah. it needs work is not going to be that helpful. So I started mm-hmm. monetizing it. And so yes. I know how to edit, but it takes time. And I think if a person is willing to invest what it takes to get that kind of expert feedback, then that's a good relationship. And so I started doing that. Then I started to do one-on-one coaching, because mm-hmm. manuscript editing really is coaching. But sometimes yeah. you're meeting people right at the beginning where they haven't written anything yet. So mm-hmm. then it's just a matter of helping them. A lot of it is encouragement. And mm-hmm. then the public speaking, that kind of has evolved as well. Writers' conferences where you start doing, you speak at, you teach workshops at writers' conferences, or you're on a panel or you moderate a panel. In the DC area, there are different writing centers like the Writers Center in Bethesda, Maryland. There's the Loft in Minneapolis, the Muse in Norfolk. And so a lot of these places I went to and did workshops in person. But then when COVID hit, a lot of this went on online, which yeah. extended the reach. So you're able mm-hmm. to reach people all over the world. And then more recently, I have incorporated the whole public speaking thing, motivational speaking, to use writing as a way to heal from grief and taking that to a wider audience.
Right.
It just is growing exponentially.
Oh, that's great. That is great. Doing all of that with the editing, with the speaking and everything, you're doing so much good for the creative community. That really is something that definitely needs to be lauded.
I hope I'm providing value and encouragement to people. There's always that moment when you send the manuscript back to someone, you're mm-hmm. being critical, but I'm able to say what I mean without being mean when I say it. But that doesn't yeah. necessarily mean that it's going to be taken that way. So it's mm-hmm. always encouraging when I hear back that I'm still on speaking terms with the person I've edited.
If I'm still on speaking terms with my editor, like, anything is possible. She could be very vicious. We're best friends, but it doesn't mean that it didn't sting.
It stings.
When I saw so much of that. But yeah. you feel it sting and everything, and then you start realizing, okay, well, maybe I need to do this instead of this.
Exactly.
If someone were to approach you, just saying that they wanted to get into, whether it's journalism, whether it's writing, whether it is speaking, as a motivational speaker, what is something that you would recommend that they do, like a first thing that they should focus on?
Well, you're really bringing up three different things. I mean, there's journalism.
Well, yeah.
And I mean, journalism has been changing. It's not necessarily a money maker now, or at least it doesn't particularly pay well. It mm-hmm. seems that a lot of the people who are making the most are the influencers who have hundreds of thousands of followers and no journalism experience.
Yep.
No editor on their shoulder going, where'd you get that? How do you, it's true. And so, yeah, journalism, that's tricky. And I think that I would recommend going to the spj.org website. That's the Society for Professional Journalists. And you will get a lot of answers about what journalism is about, what the ethics are. And from there, you'll probably get some good guidance on how you should proceed.
spj.org. I love
spj.org.
it.
spj.org. Yeah. Or .com, but I'm pretty sure it's org. It's one of those two. What was the other area? Getting into editing?
Getting into either writing or speaking.
Well, writing is, I mean, if you've got a story that just keeps nagging at you, that tells you something. And that means that you should really listen to that and not listen to the voices that tell you you suck, you have no business doing this. It's dangerous when you compare yourself to others. If you're going to compare yourself to others and find that, oh, these people really are doing great stuff. Okay, what is it that they're doing that you really want to emulate? And then try to emulate it. Try to apply to your own writing some of the things that you're seeing others do who you respect. I think it's important to write. Start to experiment. Do writing exercises. Take writing classes. Go to writing conferences. And just get better at your craft. And then there will come a point where it's time to write the book. I always recommend that people do the spade work, the prep work, to get a better sense of who your characters are and identify what your story is. There's planning and there's seat of the pantsing. I recommend both, planting, where you kind of have an idea where you're going, but it's always a good idea to allow for what I call the spooky power of the subconscious. That's when you're writing and it's almost like improv. Something shows up and you just get it down on the page without an idea of where it's going or what it's all about. Write the whole first draft without going back and trying to make it better. It's going to suck, but you will have finished. That's an important psychological hurdle to get past.
That's something that I've been dealing with a lot. And I remember the key phrase that I remember hearing a while back, perfection is the enemy of done.
Oh, man, because it's never going to be done then if you use that as the standard.
And exactly.
This is why God created rewrites. The first draft is only the first draft. And so if you can get that steaming pile of whatever done, then you go back and polish it and buff it and make it coherent and all that. But once you get it out there, that's such an important accomplishment because you went from blank page or blank screen to something that you can now really work with.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And then speaking, I think that that kind of comes with the territory after you've gotten published, because then there become opportunities to talk about your book. Libraries, rotary clubs, writers conferences. And then there are plenty of opportunities to learn how to take your message to a bigger screen. There are a lot of speaker labs and things like that that you can apply to, pay tuition for, and learn the finer points of public speaking.
Yeah, like Toastmasters and things like that.
Toastmasters, great idea.
And where can my listeners find you on social media?
Best place would be my website, which is myname.com. That's johndedakis.com. It's a tricky Greek name, so I'll spell it. J-O-H-N-D as in dog E, D as in dog A, K-I-S as in Sam.com. johndedakis.com. You've got my books there, my upcoming events and classes, and several ways to get through to me via email.
Excellent. And that's, I can't think of a better exclamation point on this discussion by knowing where you're going to be next and how you can be communicated with. Because as we've said, at the end of the day, we're all people. We all have our own issues, our own quirks. But at the end of the day, we all are looking for that sort of validation when it comes to the different things that we do. And John has definitely provided that as a service for all of his, the events that he's spoken at, all the different people that he's helped as an editor, all the different venues that he has traveled to as an author, as a journalist, everything that he has done. He continues to move forward And that is the main thing that I want for all of you. I want you all to keep moving forward with your ideas, keep moving forward with your vision, keep moving forward with your stories, because at the end of the day, in these crazy times, we need your stories, we need your vision, we need your ideas now more than ever. So for John Dudakis, this is George Soroy saying to all of you, ever upward, and I will see you next week.
Thank you very much for listening to this episode of Excelsior Journeys. I hope it was both inspiring and entertaining. Special thanks to Zach Comtois for providing new music for the intro and outro. Please take a moment to leave a rate and review on Apple Podcasts. And if you enjoy the show, please share it with your friends and subscribe to your platform of choice by going to hesgotit.com/podcasts. While there, you can also fill out the application to be a guest, inquire about sponsorship opportunities, and click on the Buy Me a Coffee link if you wish to give your support to the show. All interaction is very much appreciated. If you have a question, comment, or suggestion for the show, please direct it to George@hesgotit.com.